What if you didn't feel safe in your own country? There are major human rights issues making headlines all over the world, and this week we'll take a closer look at three hotspots: Afghanistan, Zimbabwe, and China.
The Olympics did not do what the world had been told they would do in terms of sort of promoting human rights.
I'm Susan Barnett, and you're listening to 51%, The Women's Perspective. The recession has monopolized our attention for the past several months, but the world has not stopped for us, and international problems haven't vanished while we weren't looking. Today, we're turning our attention outside the U.S. First, Laura Ayama reports on one of the world's hottest spots, Afghanistan.
The Taliban forces are moving into more areas in Afghanistan. Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commissioner, Seema Samar, doubts there can be negotiations with the Taliban.
Actually, I don't believe that there is moderate Taliban or there are moderate Taliban.
Afghanistan's government has signed international treaties on women's rights. Afghanistan's constitution includes women's rights. Samar says women must retain those rights. Eleanor Smeal, president of the Feminist Majority Foundation, details the bottom line.
Schools can't be closed to girls. Jobs have to be open. If there's food, it should be shared. If you can believe, the Taliban knocked women out of the breadlines even. So we're talking about health care services can't be closed to women and girls. They closed health care services to women and girls. So it's basic rights for human beings.
Smeal notes acid has been thrown on girls attending school, teachers executed before their students to intimidate girls who are seeking an education. The Feminist Majority Foundation has kicked off a campaign to raise money to train Afghan women to become midwives, just $3,000 per midwife. Smeal says the statistics illustrate the need.
Right now, one in six women are dying in childbirth or that first year of maternal illnesses that could be avoided. One in six. In the United States, that figure is one in 2,900. In Sweden, it's one in 29,000. So you can see the horrible, deplorable conditions.
But Ritu Sharma, who heads the group Women Thrive Worldwide, says she hopes the Obama administration's Afghanistan policy is broader than maternal mortality.
What I don't want to see in it is a section on women and girls where it's about maternal mortality, girls' education, and women's leadership. And that's sort of the U.S. strategy vis-a-vis women and girls. What I want to see is that wherever it says men, it also says women. Where we're talking about agriculture, we're talking about infrastructure, we're talking about trade, wherever it is, we are talking about making sure that women have access to some of those jobs. Of course, respecting the culture.
Sharma spoke at a Capitol Hill briefing hosted by Oxfam aimed at congressional staffers. Most U.S. aid is funneled through the Pentagon and private contractors. Oxfam and others recommend more aid through NGOs and more hiring of Afghans. Adib Faradi, Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Commerce, says that the U.S. should think about allowing foreign assistance programs to be run by South Asians rather than Americans because they cost less and are more familiar with the culture. He gave an example of how knowing Afghanistan's culture would have helped. He and other Afghans had worked out an agreement with community leaders to present to a NATO commander, who then arrived for a meeting with those community leaders.
Finally, the NATO commander came in, and after two cups of tea, he left without an agreement. So we told the local elder, why did you not resolve the issue like we discussed? And he said he was only in his second cup of tea. I was waiting for his third or fourth. And that's how things are done.
Faradi agrees that women should be included in decision-making, but he says he ran into trouble when he tried to do that in Afghanistan. That's because the Afghan government has a position in each ministry called the Gender Department, which he dissolved. Instead, he took the Gender Department women and placed them into the other departments. Faradi says the women before were an isolated, segregated department.
And the mistake was even worse because it was somehow the perception that, well, if you're a woman working for Ministry of Commerce, then you need to be in that gender department. You don't have to be in the transit department. You don't have to be in the international trade department. You don't have to be in these other, because we have a special place for you. And you cannot believe how much criticized I got from that. I had no choice but to go back and reestablish that department again.
The commerce minister says he would prefer to call USAID to Afghanistan a stimulus package, because that's what it basically means. Jobs, jobs, jobs. And he believes that's the key for women.
The only real way to empower women is for gender, is to give them economic powership. When they control the money in Afghanistan, they don't bring home the bacon, they bring home the sheep or something. That's how they get empowered.
But even as many press for the U.S. to give Afghans a greater role in reconstruction, all acknowledge that corruption is widespread in Afghanistan. So how to curb corruption there? Human rights activist Seema Samar recommends transparency, letting Afghans know about the projects and their funding.
There are a lot of mechanism auditing and making the report public. The one who does wrong things should be name and shame, in order to give the signal to the others to not do the wrong things.
Samar, who founded an organization that runs schools in Afghanistan, believes giving Afghans a greater voice in the process will help in the long run.
If the people feels the ownership, then they protect it. Involve the people and let them feel that they have the ownership of this project. I mean, my experience with the schools, it was the people who protected. And long ago, in 89, I started, during Taliban, the people protected those projects, those schools.
The Obama administration is shifting gears in Afghanistan, moving away from rhetoric about establishing democracy. Instead, there's emphasis on stability and regional partners. U.S. officials also plan to pull back from what had been the Bush administration's embrace of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Instead, the Obama administration plans to deal with more local Afghan leaders. But with the Taliban fighters again on the march in Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's not clear that calls for changes in USAID to Afghanistan will be heeded. For 51%, I'm Laura Iyama in Washington.
Oppression, you chase after the tired or the weak. Oppression, you know you mean only harm. Oppression. You reach out with your long arm, but oppression, I won't let you near me. Ah, no, oppression, you shall learn to fear me. Yes, you will. Oppression.
Coming up, a country that has fallen off the economic cliff and signs that China's human rights promises are still unfulfilled. If you missed part of our show, you can listen to us online at WAMC.org or call 1-800-323-9262 to order a CD. You'll need to know the program number. This week's show is number 1036. Let's talk about a country that, according to reports from both inside and out, has fallen apart. Zimbabwe was in the news recently after 17 pro-democracy activists were re-arrested while recovering from injuries sustained during their recent imprisonment. Justina Mkoko and other outspoken critics of the former Mugabe regime were released again, but the problems in Zimbabwe are deep and troubling. I spoke with Nomuniso Gaza, a South African activist who has been part of a hunger strike aimed at getting international attention aimed at neighboring Zimbabwe.
I am a chairperson of the Commission for Gender Equality in South Africa, but I am also involved in the Save Zimbabwe Now campaign.
Can you explain to me particularly what is going on in Zimbabwe and how long has it been going on?
All right. In Zimbabwe, you know that for a long time, there has been a struggle between the Movement for Democratic Change, which is led by Mrs. Tsvangirai, who have been calling for or a democratically elected government, and genuine democratic elections that is not manipulated by the ruling party. Over the years, the ZANU-PF government, which is the government that came to power after the liberation movement, has become more and more repressive. And after 20 years of the ZANU-PF government under the leadership of Mr. Mugabe, we suddenly saw a resurgence of populist movement. The elections were held, they were rigged, and Zimbabwe has in the last 10 years been having one form of crisis or the other after elections. However, because of the mismanagement of economy and the political system, the country has basically gotten it beyond the brink of collapse. There is no economy to speak of in Zimbabwe right now. It has collapsed beyond what is recognizable. And this is a country that used to be a food basket, a bread basket of the continent, and has now become the begging basket of the sub-region. The repression is affecting the people of Zimbabwe in ways that the world has not even begun to see. It also has a particular impact on the women of Zimbabwe. We've also seen in this period, particularly in the last 5 years, a change in the migration patterns in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe has always had workers going into South Africa as migrant workers, and especially men who were working in the mines. But what has happened is that in the last 10 years in particular, rather, we've seen more and more women going into South Africa, into neighboring countries to forage and to look for work. Of disturbing and concerning levels is the level at which there's a change in migratory patterns. There are a lot of children, particularly unaccompanied minors, that are coming in across the region, across the borders into South Africa, as orphans, as children who have nobody to look after them. I'm talking about boys here of the age between 8 and 14, 17 would be the oldest, and coming on their own. This is a new phenomenon. Also, we are seeing more and more use of rape as a political weapon. A lot of women have suffered rape in the hands of the government, in the hands of the regime, in the hands of the soldiers. A lot of women have suffered rape in the hands of the child soldiers that have been recruited by the ZANU-PF government as militia. We are also seeing a situation where the levels of humanitarian crisis have reached proportions that are way beyond what people could imagine Zimbabwe to be in. We've seen the cholera outbreak, which is an indication of a health system that is totally, totally broken down. And it's broken down not because of poverty, but it's broken down because the government is not putting any money or any investment in anything that benefits its citizens. Economy is crippled. The health system is crippled. As I speak to you right now in Zimbabwe, the children have not been to school this year. The schools are closed. As I speak to you right now in Zimbabwe, they were calling for an end to hunger and poverty.
Are you getting a response that encourages you?
I am, actually. I am amazed by the extent to which people are interested in knowing whether they can do anything and what is and what that would be. I am moved by the empathy that people are having. But of course, you do realize when you are here that people don't know as much about what is happening. And what people know is often the fact that Mugabe is not wanting to leave power. But what we're saying is that it's actually going beyond Mugabe, that you can have Mugabeism without Mugabe. What we need to concentrate on is political reform and political transformation.
That's African civil rights leader Nomuniso Gaza. Amy Agnew is based in Amnesty International's London office, and her job is to monitor what's happening in Africa, particularly in Zimbabwe. She sees the political oppression as a sign that attempts to create democracy there are being sabotaged.
It implies that there are elements within the government, specifically from the ZANU-PF party, the old ruling party who's now in this shared government, that are trying to jeopardize the new inclusive government and are using these political detainees as a sort of pawn in order to do that. It's very much the Attorney General's office that has been ensuring that the state has opposed bail and the state has failed to investigate all of these crimes. And it does seem an indication and a sort of lack of goodwill and good faith in the agreements that they've signed. They signed back in September, they signed the global political agreement between the three main political parties, ZANU-PF and the two different factions of the MDC. And signed up to a lot of sort of more human rights friendly clauses, and these kind of actions are completely undermining that agreement.
If you want to find out more, go to Amnesty International's website at amnesty.org. And finally, let's look at the ongoing problems in China. I became aware of the jailing of political dissident Liu Xiaobo after reading a letter posted online by his wife. She asked for international pressure to win the release of her husband, one of the country's leading intellectuals, along with other jailed political dissidents. And Larry Seams of the Pen American Center, an international group of writers and journalists based in New York City, says the group has a growing campaign to focus on governments that stifle free speech, including our own.
China has for many years and continues to be one of the leading jailers of writers and journalists around the world. And over the past 2 years, because it had made such explicit promises about what it would do to improve its human rights during the Olympics, or up to the Beijing Olympics, we have been focusing very closely on what's happening in China. And we've been doing it, interestingly, with one of our sister Penn centers. Penn is an international organization. We have 145 centers in 102 countries. And one of them is this independent Chinese Penn Center, which was formed in 2001. And it's made up of about 215 of China's most renowned dissident writers. About half of them live inside of China and about half outside. But they've been doing kind of really brave on-the-ground free expression advocacy work inside of China since 2001. So we launched a campaign, an Olympic year campaign. At the time that we launched the campaign, there were 40 writers in prison. And unfortunately, when it ended in October after the Olympics, there were 44. So clearly, the Olympics did not do what the world had been told they would do in terms of sort of promoting human rights. After the campaign ended in October, the Chinese authorities arrested Liu Xiaobo, who is one of China's most renowned dissident writers, has been at the forefront of dissident literature and pro-democracy activism in China since Tiananmen Square. Liu Xiaobo is also one of the early presidents of the Independent Penn Center. He was president from 2003 and 2007. So we are really trying to sort of pull out all the stops on his behalf.
I'm told that the initial reaction from the Chinese government is that we do not accept input from organizations outside our country.
One of our real concerns is that, Liu Xiaobo is arrested in that sort of dead zone between President Obama's election and his inauguration. And, you know, it's during a time of very dire economic news. And I think the Chinese authorities figured that they could sort of move against him at a time when the world was preoccupied. What was very disappointing for Penn and, you know, for many human rights organizations was that when the Obama administration made its sort of first official comments about human rights in China, which was during Secretary of State Clinton's trip to China in February, those comments suggested that the United States was going to take a much more kind of real politique position, and that human rights would be sort of a backseat issue to more pressing economic concerns. And I think one of the things that we're really hoping is that by generating a good deal of attention to Liu Xiaobo's case, The Obama administration understands why it's so important that, it too take a public stand for his release as well.
As writers, is there any concern about the erosion of the constitutional rights in this country under the last administration, which haven't necessarily been rolled back yet by this administration?
No, that's a great question. It's one of our leading preoccupations, I have to say. I mean, at Penn, we watched with great alarm and discouragement the rapid increase in arrests and jailings of writers and journalists around the world after 9/11. And that was in part because a lot of repressive governments saw what was happening in the United States, looked at, anti-terrorism laws like the Patriot Act, looked at arbitrary detention that was happening in Guantanamo, pointed to those things to justify their old kind of age-old repression. So we, starting in 2003, Penn American Center has been spending almost half of our time really trying to confront some of the threats and pressures on freedom of expression in the United States since September 11th. We have this thing called the Campaign for Core Freedoms that's really focused on trying to push back against some of these things that have constricted the climate for freedom of expression and that have really eroded some of the most fundamental due process protections, the kinds of things that other governments use to jail people like Liu Xiaobo. So it's just really crucial that as Americans we understand that, in order to go out into the world with any credibility on these issues, we have to clean our own house first.
All right, and you're far more on top of this than I am. Is there any motion so far from Washington to restore some of those threats?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the signals are maddeningly mixed, I would have to say. I mean, the early executive orders that Guantanamo would be closed within a year, very clear, executive orders and statements about, that effectively re-ban torture. Let's remember it was always banned under U.S. and international law, but affirm that ban, I think are positive signs. There's no question about it. On the other hand, there are there were many sort of changes that are now deeply embedded in the law, and some of these things like surveillance, the NSA telephone and internet surveillance program, the details of which have yet to be known, and the Obama administration has, strangely, I think, and kind of disappointedly, adopted a kind of pro-secrecy posture in some of the key court cases that continues to make it difficult to even learn the details of the program, let alone roll them back. So there's a great deal of work to be done. I think the climate is certainly more positive. What we've seen in terms of the discussion about torture in the last 2 weeks, I think we're clearly reaching a tipping point in the public's consciousness about the fact that torture did happen. It was not a sort of an isolated set of incidences by people in the field, but it was the result of very carefully articulated policies from the administration. These things are becoming clear. What needs to be done is we need to figure out how we have accountability for these things and debate about whether there will be prosecutions, whether there will be an independent commission investigation. These things are up in the air, but it is so important that we as a society not only get the facts, but have a discussion about how responsibility for these things is shared, in fact, society-wide.
For more information on Liu Xiaobo and other writers jailed for their opinions, go to the Penn American Center's website at penn.org. That's it for this week. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks to Katie Britton and Glenn Busby for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. And thank you for listening. Join us again next week for 51%, The Women's Perspective.